to rely heavily upon indigenous administrators such as mayors and headmen, and further down upon native auxiliary police. "The Germans were here for a long time," recalled one local eyewitness from the Army Group North region after the war, "but they were rarely in our village. This was because there were more indigenous police there. The Germans only came to bring or take someone away." The Germans used this native administration to collect agricultural products, taxation, and other items, and to help maintain order. From late 1942, moreover, the administration was charged with providing workers for the German war economy. In return, native administrators received various perks, such as emergency rations at times when rations were otherwise being cut. They also exploited widely the opportunities for corruption and nepotism that their position provided. The native administration was also deficient because the great majority of experienced administrators had left with the Soviet retreat. The results were plain in the day-to-day running of the occupied territories. For instance, GFP Group 721, which served in the Gatyatashchenkov-Mirgorod region of the Ukraine, reported in January 1942 that it regularly had to check rayon, district chiefs, and mayors for reliability. Indeed, in some places, the mayor and the militia were getting drunk. GFP Group 721 also feared that former communist functionaries were infiltrating the administration to sabotage it and give the partisans direct and indirect help. When it came to policing its occupied territories, the military administration could call on the Einsatzkommandos and Sonderkommandos of the Security Police and SD, and on the Wehrmacht's own GFP. Reports by GFP Group 721 provide insight into the organization's everyday activities. Each GFP post had a strength of one officer, one NCO, and 48 men. By employing reliable native informers as well as captured partisans, they were able to establish the partisans' strength, weaponry, equipment, and route of march. Where possible, each GFP post maintained a sniffer dog or guard dog for keeping watch and for assisting with transporting captured partisans. Group 721 ran transit camps in Lubny and Khorol, where it concentrated captured partisans and communist functionaries before handing them over to the SD. In some respects, Group 721 treated the population with some consideration. In Lubny, for instance, it turned over several houses and conducted lengthy investigations following reports that several of the town's inhabitants were planning to attack the Germans. But it did not inflict a reprisal on the village unless it had unearthed proof of the inhabitants' complicity first. But in January 1942, GFP Group 721 complained that its men were seriously overburdened. The occupation administration also needed a large body of army manpower if it was to keep its jurisdictions pacified. By the summer of 1942, there were approximately 30,000 to 50,000 security troops in every army group rear area and approximately 5,000 to 10,000 in every army rear area. Among these totals, however, was a large number of native auxiliaries, men who usually entered German service in the hope of paid work and better rations. They usually had scant reason to feel enthusiastic about the Germans. For by the spring of 1942, the Germans had squandered most of the goodwill that some sections of the Western Soviet Union's population had at first shown them. One of the many reasons, something that had taken place under the population's noses, was the mass death of Soviet POWs. A more practical reason was the dire food situation across the occupied territories. The high-level directives that the likes of Göring and Wagner had issued during the summer and autumn of 1941 had set the stage by cutting the rations available to the population as a whole and by discriminating particularly against those sections of the population not directly working for the Germans. The OKH, apparently mindful that many German soldiers were taking pity on the starving population, announced in November 1941 that the German soldier would be inclined to give some of his rations to the population, but he must say to himself, "Every gram of bread or other food that I give the population of the occupied territories out of the goodness of my heart, I am taking away from the German people, and therefore my family." The German soldier therefore needs to remain hard in view of the starving women and children. If he doesn't do this, he endangers the food supply of our people. The enemy is now experiencing the fate he had intended for us. He alone bears the responsibility before the world and history. The local Kommandanturen were responsible for cooperating with the Wirtschaftskommandos to oversee food distribution, while native communal administrations did the actual distributing. During 1942, the Kommandanturen tried to make good at least some of the damage that German policy had already wrought. Yet such were the obstacles facing them that they achieved very limited success. One reason for this was that army administrators were often at loggerheads with the Army Wirtschaftsführer and Wirtschaftsinspektionen of Wirtschaftsstab Ost. For instance, Wirtschaftsinspektion South despoiled the rear areas of Army Group South and then of Army Group B, areas that included the grain-producing regions of the Ukraine. In Kharkov, 30 people were dying of hunger each day by the beginning of August 1942. While General of Infantry Erich Friederizi, the commander of the Army Group B rear area, accused Wirtschaftsinspektion South of inflicting quotas upon the population similar to those of Bolshevik times, the inspectorate retorted by blaming the shortages on disruption caused by partisans. This was an unsubtly veiled complaint that the rear area administration itself was failing to keep the partisan threat under control. Similarly, the Army Group Center rear area clashed with Wirtschaftsinspektion Center. Its own urban areas suffered severely from hunger, particularly when an influx of refugees swelled the total population from 550,000 to 800,000. In some ways, the population of the Army Group North rear area had it even worse. There were fewer mouths to feed, but also fewer means with which to feed them. The region already lacked much in the way of cultivatable land and mechanized farming equipment, and the Germans in the north were particularly desperate to seize horses and carts for the front. Wirtschaftsinspektion North piled on the population's misery by doubling or sometimes quadrupling food quotas to be seized. The prospect of starvation also threatened law and order, as black markets flourished and hundreds of thousands of urban dwellers poured into the countryside on foraging expeditions. Such Hamsterfahrten also disrupted railway transport when civilians wandered across railway lines en masse. Officers on the ground described what all of this meant for civilians. In August 1942, Emmerich P. described civilians standing before German field kitchens and begging in a miserable condition. The adults already show the signs of the last stage of hunger, namely swollen feet and faces. Children with swollen bellies, otherwise just skin and bone, with an ashen corpse-like look. I've arranged for the neighboring village, which has not slaughtered its cows and is therefore coping better, to provide 20 liters, 35 pints, of milk every day for the children of our village. He also had a macabre but all too common tale to recount. A young woman who is working here at the Kommandantur had her child stolen. Another woman had enticed the child away. We found this woman with three children whom she had enticed away from home with promises that they could look at her lovely little puppies, etc. Here's the ghoulish bit. She was planning to eat them. Further east, some field armies, such as the 2nd and 3rd Panzer armies, had enough transportation to allow them to feed the population. However, the field armies that marched even further east during Operation Blue in 1942 encountered, or sometimes created, an even more ruinous food supply situation. The 17th Army, advancing through the Donbass, felt compelled to go plundering because it was in an industrial area with little agricultural land. Its economic office even recommended that the army set up ghettos to separate the starving from its own troops. The army command thought this would also be a good way of sealing off what it saw as the particularly hardcore communist population of the Donbass, though in the event it lacked the troops needed to guard what would have been an enormous ghetto. Meanwhile, the 11th Army plundered the Crimea together with the Wirtschaftskommando on the spot, and by the end of 1942, 100,000 people in the southern part of the peninsula had starved to death. Matters across the occupied areas improved marginally in September 1942 when the German authorities began distributing ration cards. However, these were only intended for people who could either work or prove they were unable to work. Actual ration levels did not improve. and in the case of bread they sank even further. That said, the hunger of the winter of 1942 to 1943 was marginally less dreadful than the previous winters, and from March 1943 onward, the German occupation authorities began distributing food in a more coordinated, effective manner. A grisly reason why this was becoming easier, however, was that so many civilians had already been deported or had died from starvation. Later in 1943, a flood of refugees from the fighting further east raised population levels again. Facing this situation, Wirtschaftsstab Ost reduced the number of people entitled to rations from 1.4 million to 800,000. Populations in the rear of Army Group North, however, experienced a more sustained marginal improvement on the miserable depths of the winter of 1941 to 1942. Here, the Germans helped their cause by storing and distributing to the population some of the produce they had originally seized from it. This was a calculating measure rather than a moral one. They used hunger as a weapon to help ensure the population's orderly behavior, and until 1943 at least, it seems to have worked. Settlements further to the rear were not in close proximity to marauding frontline troops, and civilians who worked received higher rations. A more ghoulish factor, of course, was that the mass deaths of the previous winter left more food to go around. Active collaborators received access to additional food and also to payments in kind, such as tobacco. However, the bulk of the more privileged working section of Army Group North's civilian population still suffered great misery. In the town of Slutsk in July 1942, the daily ration of 300 grams, 10 ounces of bread for workers and 150 grams, 5 ounces for non-workers was little better than what the besieged population of Leningrad was living on during November and December 1941. German policy in the Army Group North area also alleviated the population's misery more than German policy elsewhere because northern Russia had fewer mouths to feed in the first place. In the face of hunger, army administrators sought to win civilians' hearts and minds, ensure they worked effectively for the Germans, and preempt them from joining resurgent partisan groups. One flagship reform the Germans initially tried to trumpet was privatization of the collective farming system. This was announced for the northern and central occupied sectors on 15 February 1942. The civilian and army occupation administrators who backed the reform believed it would appeal to the spirit of free enterprise among Soviet farmers by giving them a genuine economic stake in the German occupation. However, though the reform contained elements of private enterprise, the central economic planners in Berlin wanted to keep the Soviet command system largely intact in order to maximize the amount of agricultural yields that could be seized for the German market. And the Ukraine was excluded from the reform entirely until the autumn of 1942. It was the occupation authorities of Army Group North who again gave the reforms greater credibility than army administrators elsewhere. They allocated more generous amounts of land and also granted collaborators a limited amount of further land on which to grow their own produce. A Soviet report of September 1943 concerning the occupied Leningrad Oblast province described how many peasants were farming their own portion of former collective farmland, around 2 or 3 hectares, 5 or 7.5 acres, per family with a male member able to work, with a horse at each family's disposal. Yet the fact that the benefits of the agricultural reform, such as they were felt sooner and more perceptibly in northern Russia than in the more agriculturally important Ukraine, reflects the policy's essential bankruptcy. More generally, as the partisan movement began re-establishing itself, farmers often came to fear being given an individual farm under the reform in case it made them targets for partisan reprisals. German troops' plunder of livestock and the Soviet scorched earth policies had together wrought havoc upon agriculture in 1941, and the too often paltry reality of the Germans' much-vaunted reform was not enough to remedy the damage. German army administrators also tried to compensate with educational and religious reforms. While Hitler and the Nazi leadership wanted the Slavs reduced to a primitive serf-like level, army administrators realized they needed qualified people to help them run the economy. They also recognized that re-establishing an effective school system was a good means of keeping children and teenagers under control and away from partisan influence. In June 1942, Emmerich P. initiated the teaching of German for adults and children, which has now been running for the past few days. There's a lot of demand for the courses. We have 150 students already, and that will certainly increase. However, in this, as in so many other areas, the Germans relied completely upon native personnel to run the schools. "You ask me whether I'm running the German school myself," Emmerich P. continued. "No, the Russians alone have to do that. We Germans are only meant to initiate the idea and set the direction, otherwise nothing will come of it." Yet in occupied Belarus particularly, far too many teachers had fled or been killed, and those who were available feared being marked out as collaborators. There was also a dearth of school books. The 281st Security Division in the Army Group North rear area tried to get around this problem with a sport-heavy curriculum, which, while fun for many of the pupils, was of limited use otherwise. Many children were unable to attend school because of the distances involved in getting there. The Ninth Army had a harsher way of controlling its civilian population. In 1942, it established a camp for children roaming around its jurisdiction and charged Sonderkommandos 7A and 7B with catching them. Generals von Schenkendorf and Karl von Rock, the latter of whom commanded the Army Group South rear area during 1941 and again during the second half of 1942, also sought to restore freedom of worship to the occupied population. For instance, 1,500 churches were reopened across the army-controlled areas of the Ukraine. It helped that the SS was not murdering the Russian and Ukrainian clergy in the way it had the Polish clergy. Emmerich P. described the scene when he gave permission for a Russian Orthodox church to be built in May 1942. "Yesterday I received a deputation headed by a Russian priest with a long beard, staff, and flowing robe, with a request to build a Russian church. God protect the liberator Adolf Hitler, who has given Russia back its God," he proclaimed, as I declared to him that we were giving permission. He then stooped to the ground and promised we would be eternally in the people's thoughts and prayers. "Nothing can be done here without religion. It gives the elderly a real sense of belonging, which can be politically exploited, and can more easily direct the spiritually lost youth towards a moral way of living." Frontline divisions also played the religion card in order to placate the population in their sectors. The 126th Infantry Division, another Army Group North formation, made a point of respecting places of worship in its area, even though it also widely used public hangings and shootings to deter resistance. However, a shortage of working churches and a plethora of ecclesiastical structures hindered the Germans' efforts. Army Group South forbade its own troops to allow civilians to participate in Wehrmacht field services. And though the army's religious initiatives were generally well received by the older generation and in rural areas, they brought little success otherwise. To woo younger people and urban dwellers, the Germans reopened theatres, cinemas, and dance halls, but the disruptions of wartime prevented these venues from regaining their pre-war standards. Alfred Rosenberg's Eastern Ministry was in overall charge of German propaganda in the occupied Soviet Union. Its brief included trumpeting the achievements of the occupation. Goebbels's propaganda ministry, the SS, and the Wehrmacht also produced propaganda. Among the propaganda messages were that the Soviets had started the war, and that the German invasion had been a preemptive strike against an imminent Soviet invasion of Europe. In the Baltic region and the Ukraine, German propaganda often exploited local anti-Semitism by linking Bolshevism with Jews. It also stressed the Germans' military and political superiority, though this in particular proved an increasingly hard sell as the war dragged on. As the security situation in the occupied territories worsened, civilians were urged to support the German anti-partisan campaign or, it was implied, face German terror. Leaflets, photographs, staged exhibitions, and the printed press were all deployed. For example, in the rear area of Army Group B in July 1942, Propaganda Section Ukraine produced 19 newspapers with an overall circulation of 265,000. Similarly, the Army Group's center rear area saw the production of numerous propaganda newspapers with names like The Bell and The Turning Point. But although copious propaganda material was produced, the size of the occupied territory, the terrain, and proliferating partisan attacks limited its distribution. Radio propaganda was also employed, but because radio was banned in private homes, the Germans had to rely on loudspeaker vans, of which there were only limited numbers. Public speakers were an effective propaganda method if they could be found, but the Germans often had to coerce them. Conversely, some German propaganda measures backfired. For instance, occupied civilians were sometimes taken on trips to Germany to demonstrate how wonderful it was. Although many felt inspired to offer their services as propaganda speakers when they returned, their talks often led civilians to ask why Germans were well-fed while they themselves went hungry. In January 1943, the intelligence officer of Army Group Center remarked, "Even the prettiest promises or the most impressive speech by a Russian in our service can't make good the loss of a cow or a home." Similarly, in July 1942, Emmerich P. recognized that here the Germans are credited with saving many people from starvation. Such propaganda of deed is more valuable practically than columns of propaganda material. Many commanders believed the best day-to-day propaganda was the conduct of the German soldier himself. In the autumn of 1942, for instance, officers investigating soldierly indiscipline in Army Group Center reported, "If, after the departure of a unit, all the chickens in a village are still alive, then the troops concerned have done more for our cause than perhaps an army propaganda company that has held a talk lasting for hours." That said, the direction that commanders received from above seemed to face two ways. On 27 May 1942, the OKH issued a directive stating, "The German soldier should be received as the master in the East, but mastery should never express itself in contempt towards defenseless, defeated people. The Russian is obedient and willing if he is treated in a hard but fair manner." Yet the directive also stated, "A degree of harshness is also needed. Any weakness and softness is entirely misplaced. Where civilians act against military directives, where they act against members of the German Wehrmacht, or threaten them, or intend or carry out any violent act, they are to be immediately treated ruthlessly by order of the responsible officer in line with regulations." Such mixed messages did not make it any easier for commanders on the ground to instill consistently correct behavior among their troops. Commanders who sought to persuade or compel their troops to moderate their behavior could face an uphill struggle, given the impact of years of anti-Slavic prejudice and propaganda. Anti-Slavism was widespread among the troops, although exactly how widespread cannot be known. Even so, soldiers expressed a range of views. Unteroffizier Willy P. spoke for many who felt their prejudices to be vindicated when they experienced the Russians' primitive living conditions. "In the evenings, we arrive at these Russian kennels and spend the night in the stinking holes with 10 or 20 people, the majority on the floor, which is often just earth and not covered with floorboards. Not to mention the fact that they often have 10 children, with cats, sheep, and pigs among them. They have no handkerchiefs, and they also go on the floor. Oh, one could write volumes about this." Other soldiers encountered similar conditions, but reacted with more pity. Such, for instance, was the case with a soldier from the 121st Infantry Division. "They live as best as one can in an apathy that was reflected in their faces. Joy and pleasure were dead, the belief in a better future taken away." And in April 1942, Private Fritz S. of the 25th Infantry Division described his first experience of Russians on his journey to the front. "The first overnight stay with Russian farmers was really great. The Russian houses just consist of one room. 15 people live there, and 7 German soldiers were added to that. The Russians personally were very friendly towards us." German soldiers relied on Soviet civilians not only for security and agricultural work, but also as black marketeers. Black marketeering was particularly rife in the Army Group North area. Soldiers in Lithuania and Estonia used cigarettes and schnapps to secure better deals on the black market, and a ban of May 1942 did not deter them. For some soldiers, Soviet cities were not so much repellent as exciting. Unteroffizier Wolfgang S. of the 7th Panzer Division described a visit to the fleshpots of Kharkov in the spring of 1943. Kharkov is one of the most interesting cities in the East, half destroyed yet full of bustle and a volume of traffic like Berlin in peacetime. Women a la the Kafurstendamm, alongside bearded beggars, strumpets and their prey, rogues, spivs and honest types who go hungry, a mini-Babylon for Lanzers, common foot soldiers who want to make love and spend money. The fact that occupation troops were generally older than their frontline comrades could make them more considerate towards civilians. This was not just because older soldiers were more subject to influences other than Nazism, but also because thoughts of their own wives and children could soften their treatment of Russian families. Relations between individual German soldiers and Russian women could often be very agreeable. Despite official bans on sexual contact between them, including measures announced by Wirtschaftsstab Ost in early 1942, Himmler estimated that over 1 million illegitimate babies were born to Russian women and German soldiers over the course of the war. It is unlikely that Himmler carried out rigorous research to arrive at this figure, but Second Lieutenant Helmut D. of the 4th Mountain Division, for one, conceded the general point. "Relations with the population are good," he wrote in a letter of May 1942, "but I have had to impress upon my Lanzers the fact that the Russians are still our enemies. I've even had to send a couple of soldiers home when I've seen them behaving improperly with girls. The Lancer has been far from home a long time, away from his wife or girlfriend, and is in need of a bit of tenderness. Spring's arrival has its effect too, of course." However, sexual relations between German soldiers and Soviet women were often anything but tender. Rape was widespread, and a third of all cases seemed to have been gang rapes. Although cases that reached military courts were usually punished strongly, there were far fewer prosecutions for rape in the occupied East than in the occupied West. German commanders and military courts did intervene if they believed that a violent sexual crime might significantly damage soldierly discipline or relations with the population. But the threshold they set in the East was much higher than it was in the West. In the East, though the policy remained unspoken, many officers seemed to have turned a blind eye to such violations, believing them a necessary means of allowing their men to let off steam following the pressures of battle. Rapes were less likely to be reported by German eyewitnesses who held Soviet women in racial contempt, and even if they were reported, that same racial contempt often stopped the military authorities from taking them seriously. The authorities also disregarded racial considerations concerning sexual contact with Slavic women more generally. Accordingly, they established Wehrmacht brothels in the East as in parts of the West. Their main concern was for discipline, for they believed regulated brothels gave the troops a safe outlet through which to satisfy their sexual needs and savor the fruits of victory, without engaging in rape, gang rape, or homosexual encounters. They were also concerned about security. Memoranda issued by Field Marshal Keitel in the autumn of 1942 stressed that unsolicited relations between German soldiers and native women could lead to spy activities and a complete blurring of the necessary distance to the people of the occupied Eastern territories. In contrast with Wehrmacht brothels in occupied Western Europe, attractive local women were often press-ganged for the brothels in the East. Brothels were also established so that the women working there could be monitored for sexually transmitted diseases. And in Russia, disease prevention sometimes took lethal form. In December 1941, 28th Corps, which served under the 18th Army in northwest Russia, overruled an Ortskommandant to decree that over 200 women in the local mental asylum, many of whom were suffering from syphilis, were to be shot by the SD. In November 1942, the SD shot a further 50 women infected with STDs. Fear about STDs, together with the aforementioned worries about security, may well have been behind the rise in prosecutions of sexual misdemeanors from 1943 onwards. Nor was there necessarily anything sweet about many of the consensual liaisons that took place. In the words of Dieter Pohl, there was, considering occupied civilians' often appalling economic circumstances, a fluid line between loving relations and poverty prostitution. Contempt for the population, or at least utter disregard for it, was also clear in the countless cases of unrestricted, unauthorized plunder that took place. Army Rear Area 582, the 9th Army's occupation zone, had an official policy of leaving private peasant property alone so that the population was guaranteed at least some supplies, but its troops often ignored this ruling. Its officers also disapproved of their soldiers going fishing with hand grenades. There could be particular problems when frontline troops took up temporary residence in the rear. In September 1942, Emmerich P. wrote, "We are currently assembling a police troop from the locals, otherwise there'll be no houses left by the end of winter. Whatever isn't guarded visibly by a gun is torn up, stolen, destroyed. It is, of course, forbidden, but should the Lanzer freeze? No, he helps himself and takes a good window casement from another house. I have dark forebodings for the winter." Medical supplies were often also seized, and local hospitals debilitated in the process. An April 1942 report by Einsatzgruppe A on conditions in the 18th Army's area maintained that the territory's hospitals had degenerated into centers of contagion. Plunder and requisitioning, particularly of living quarters, were also widespread in urban areas where German soldiers massively outnumbered the locals. At times, for instance, the population of Smolensk comprised 30,000 regular inhabitants, but also 50,000 soldiers. Plunder and requisitioning also led to riots and, inevitably, increased support for the partisans. Yet although German commands frequently issued orders against unsolicited plunder, there is little evidence that German military courts punished it systematically. Officers often saw plunder as part of a survival strategy, or as another opportunity for the troops to channel their frustrations against a supposedly racially inferior population. Furthermore, so much unauthorized plunder took place that it could be immensely difficult to control. Overall, if the German soldiers' everyday behavior was indeed the military administration's greatest propaganda weapon, it was double-edged at best. Together with food, the bitterest bone of contention between occupier and occupied was the German drive for labor. The Germans were using native labor within the Soviet Union for their own purposes from late 1941, and rear area units were not the only ones involved in seizing it. In the summer of 1942, for instance, the 121st Infantry Division, operating under the 18th Army in northwest Russia, was instrumental in rounding up and transferring labor in Pavlovsk and Pushkin for work under other German organizations in the east. In 1942, the Nazi plenipotentiary for labor allocation, Fritz Sauckel, was empowered to ransack the occupied territories for workers to be sent to the Reich. Sauckel initially used bribery, using promises of good treatment and of a living wage that would benefit workers' families amid the grim economic conditions of wartime. Accordingly, Emmerich P. cited a letter from one worker to her family conveying a rosy image of life in Germany. "Almost all letters show," he wrote, "that Germany has exceeded the expectations of the Russian workers who have been sent there. The town is actually quite exasperated by the letters. Lots of girls are crying who did not work up the courage at the time to go and work in Germany. It was better propaganda for us than 10 trucks full of propaganda material." By October 1942, nearly 700,000 Eastern workers, Ostarbeiter, were in Germany, in a foreign workforce that now numbered over 3 million. Ostarbeiter often suffered appalling pay and conditions at the hands of rapacious German employers. On average, 1,200 Ostarbeiter died in Germany every month. The main killer was tuberculosis. When tales of maltreatment and suffering inevitably reached home, the initial surge of volunteers evaporated. Sauckel now came under intensified pressure to procure Ostarbeiter by whatever means. He was empowered to compel both army and civilian occupation authorities to deploy native representatives to ensure that the population complied with his demands. In October 1942, Feldkommandantur 197 in the Army Group B rear area deplored the spectacle of female labor draft evaders being hauled from their forest hiding places as a scene resembling a manhunt. Sauckel resorted not just to coercion, but also to trickery. For instance, a local population might be invited to a film show and then have all its able-bodied members seized. Sauckel was driven by his own anti-Slavism and by his determination to bulldoze through his demands against other agencies' wishes. Zaukel's greatest obstacle on this score was the army, albeit for practical rather than moral reasons. On 16 March 1943, for instance, Zaukel announced he needed 1 million extra workers over the next 4 months. The army evaded or ignored his demands because it needed native labor for its own purposes in the east. Commanders such as the Second Army's General von Weichs in early 1942 advocated a compulsory labor service, but others had grave misgivings. General von Schenkendorf wanted, at the very least, rigorous regulation and an end to excesses against Ostarbeiter. Attempts to improve conditions were indeed made. A May 1943 directive, for instance, forbade the physical abuse of Ostarbeiter and required that they receive decent food rations, sanitation, and clothing. How far these measures were enacted depended on the goodwill of German employers. Furthermore, Allied bombing made it increasingly difficult for the Germans to house Ostarbeiter adequately. General Friederizi, who commanded the Army Group South rear area during 1942 and 1943, wanted a major drive to sell labor service to the population. Both civilian and military authorities employed various propaganda measures to this end. Some, such as the practice of marching volunteers to the railway station with a morale-boosting musical accompaniment, were bizarre. Others were more grounded. For instance, native reporters were allowed into German firms to observe conditions. But with multiple ongoing stories of poor treatment and the population's growing realization, particularly after Stalingrad, that Germany was not winning the war, none of these measures remained effective. The labor draft was the most pressing of the many grievances that boosted popular support for the partisans from 1942 onwards. That year, the Soviet regime finally gave partisans the coordination and practical support they needed. A new central partisan headquarters directed that new partisan groups comprise a mixture of activists from the local area, militia, and NKVD commandos. Partisans grew increasingly adept at cultivating popular support in the areas that came under their control. The stabilized front line and the Soviet war economy's growing output vastly improved the partisans' supply and communications. Major challenges remained. Among other things, partisans were ordered to cultivate willing popular support among the widest swath of the population, but many partisan groups were plagued by discipline problems and often raped, plundered, maltreated, or even murdered civilians. To a large extent, Stalin's regime itself directed partisans to be ruthless, viewing the occupied population as a tool in the cause of victory. Partisans could be particularly merciless towards collaborators, and indeed sometimes towards collaborators' families. The State Defense Committee decreed that one family member's treason was enough to implicate the rest of his family. Conversely, if one family member exhibited patriotic conduct, including support for the partisan movement, then this could exonerate his or her family from the crimes of a close relative. Many partisan groups wooed hearts and minds through effective anti-German propaganda. Among other things, by September 1942, partisans were employing two-sided tactics, still going after civilian administrators with a vengeance, but also enticing members of indigenous auxiliary units to come over. They also set up administrative apparatus and provided a range of services to the populations of the areas they controlled. They flourished most in areas more accessible to supply through the front line, among swampy and forested terrain, or among populations especially hard hit by German occupation. For these reasons, the great majority of partisans operating in the army-occupied zone could be found in Belarus, in the occupied regions of Great Russia to the east of it, or in the northeast Ukraine. German soldiers all along the front were alarmed at the partisans' rising activity, and sometimes astonished at their fortitude. In May 1942, for instance, Lieutenant Richard D. of the 7th Panzer Division wrote, "Of the partisans who have lately been captured, two girls were shot after a lengthy interrogation. One was 17 years old, the other 19. They had been captured using an anti-tank gun, and it was nothing to them to have to strip off before being shot. Neither of them cried or trembled." By the end of 1942, partisans were also disrupting the economy of the occupied territories, killing agricultural leaders, cutting transportation, and attacking mills and other installations. For instance, Army Group North reported that agricultural activity was being disrupted across all its jurisdictions as early as June 1942. In 1942, when the German occupation was less rapacious than it would become, and German victory still looked plausible, the unpredictable brutality of many partisan groups made the Germans look the least worst option to many civilian eyes. The Germans particularly appealed to mayors and headmen to aid them against the partisans. Self-interested civilians became informers or joined the indigenous auxiliary police or the order service, Ordnungsdienst or OD organizations with varied policing duties that became increasingly active in the anti-partisan campaign. This kind of native help also freed up more rear area German troops for the front. Overall, the German army responded to the partisans and to the civilian populations that might or might not be supporting them with a self-defeating mix of half-baked restraint and alienating brutality. While most conventional armies may fear and despise irregular warfare, the sheer scale of the body count resulting from the German army's anti-partisan campaign cannot be attributed solely to this. Anti-Slavism and the German military's markedly pronounced hatred for irregular warfare together increased the distrust conventional troops felt towards the civilians in an area where an insurgency was taking place. The army also developed its anti-partisan tactics during 1942. One, which General Hulda promoted, was the formation of Jagdkommandos, hunter groups. These were relatively small, lightly equipped, but well-armed units of highly motivated troops designed to reconnoiter, gather intelligence, and generally move and fight as partisans did. However, Jagdkommandos were never used as extensively as they might have been. The army's most favored method for combating partisans became the Großunternehmen, large-scale operation. A Großunternehmen could vary in form, but the basic premise was the same. The Germans isolated a suspected partisan-supporting area with an outer cordon of troops, then mobile troops cleansed the surrounding area. More often than not, however, the partisans could move faster and knew the terrain, while the German forces were too few and too pressed for time. This often enabled partisans to avoid engagements and slip the cordon. Such was the experience of the 12th Panzer Division, one of numerous frontline units that participated in anti-partisan operations. Its after-action report for November 1942's Operation Monkey Cage remarked, "The troops must be trained in anti-bandit warfare. Success is dependent on a systematic combing of every nook, house, lodging, oven, cellar, floor, and so on. For this, the troops need time. With Operation Monkey Cage against the division's own advice, insufficient time was allocated to comb everywhere." Consequently, many anti-partisan units turned on the area's civilian population during the course of operations so that they could notch up a high body count that they could then pass off as partisan dead. Death tolls were also high because German troops often took little, if any, care to distinguish between who was a partisan and who a civilian. Difficult to make as this distinction often was, many German commanders were disinclined even to try, so ingrained were their anti-Slavic and guerrilla-phobic sentiments. Considerable numbers of actual partisans may also have been killed because, being untrained in conventional combat, they were likely to come off badly against German or Allied troops in face-to-face fighting. Such cases were especially common during the movement's early phase. Then again, some partisans were better trained and equipped than the substandard German troops sent against them, and even more so than the Germans' indigenous auxiliaries. Also commonplace were massive contrasts between numbers of partisans reported killed and numbers of weapons found on them. This too indicates that huge numbers of partisans whom the Germans were supposedly killing were indeed non-combatants. In the Vitebsk region during September 1942, for instance, the 201st Security Division killed 864 partisans in combat and handed over a further 245 to the GFP for execution. But it produced just 99 rifles, pistols, and machine guns from the entire 1,100-plus body count. The division's own losses were 8 dead and 25 wounded. Whatever other partial explanations there may be for such yawning contrasts, such as partisan units sometimes hiding their weapons, it is clear that far too many German army units did not discriminate between genuine partisans and non-combatants. In the central sector of the occupied Soviet Union alone, the anti-partisan campaign is estimated to have destroyed over 5,000 villages and killed up to 300,000 people, predominantly non-combatants. Hideous as the civilian loss of life was, however, Großunternehmen could bring one concrete military benefit. While they rarely destroyed partisan groups outright, they frequently disrupted them. Yet the Germans failed to follow up such successes as these operations did achieve. They did not station enough troops in the combed areas afterwards, or, more generally, maintain a permanent visible troop presence among rural populations more widely. Thus, even if civilians often threw in their lot with the partisans only grudgingly, the absence of any secure long-term German presence in their area usually left them no choice. Some anti-partisan units behaved less brutally than others. At the end of July 1942, the 3rd Panzer Army ordered that whenever civilians were executed, the reasons should be made clear to the population, and that the first principle must be the further pacification of the land and winning the population's trust. In northwest Russia, the Germans' relatively sensible food policy, together with the fact that partisans were thin on the ground compared with further south, enabled the Germans to pursue a relatively sensible anti-partisan policy also. For villages here often felt less of the desperation that compelled many further south to support the partisans, and were thus more likely to spurn the partisans for fear of antagonizing the Germans. Even in the Army Group Center area, still the main arena of the Army's war against the partisans, some anti-partisan units showed more restraint than others. The 221st Security Division served in the southern part of the Army Group Center rear area during 1942. During 1941, it had taken a harsh line against Jews, refugees, and any other real or imagined threat to security. But by the summer of 1942, the 221st Divisional Command was appreciating that unbridled terror was likely to increase the partisan support in the long term. The 221st's change of commander from the Eastern German Lieutenant General Johann Flugbeil to the Western German Major General Hubert Lendl may have helped, but what seems particularly to have brought the 221st to its senses was its situation. At times, the struggle against partisans was not intense enough to prevent the slower but more effective approach of appealing to the population's hearts and minds. Particularly far-sighted, relatively speaking, was its policy on deserters. On 3 December, the 221st's intelligence section criticized the higher-level decree that partisans surrendering during or after an operation should be shot. An enemy with only the prospect of death staring him in the face will fight bitterly and tenaciously to the end. The 201st Security Division makes for a brutal contrast with the 221st. During the winter of 1942 to 1943, the 201st executed a sequence of operations at the northern end of the Army Group Center rear area. This was a region more strategically important than the 221st's and with more partisans. Under greater high-level scrutiny and anxious to demonstrate its ruthless credentials compared with the SS and police units operating in the region, the 201st's operations killed far more people than the 221st's did. One telling statistic is that 43 partisan deserters came over to the 201st between mid-June and the end of December 1942. During the same period, 10 times as many came over to the 221st. Anti-partisan units might also exercise restraint because they often lacked the manpower and firepower even to attempt destructive Großunternehmen. Such was the case, for instance, among the especially poorly provisioned security divisions of Army Group North. In May 1942, for example, Soviet partisan reports in the Idritsa area acknowledged that the Germans were not just threatening peasants with violence for aiding the partisans, but were also rewarding peasants with money, provisions, or land in return for their help against the partisans. Conversely, a particularly well-equipped unit could try something more militarily ambitious than a bludgeoning indiscriminate Großunternehmen. In April 1943, the 281st Security Division carried out Operation Spring Clean in the southern sector of Army Group North's areas. Against 4 partisan brigades, it committed 5,000 troops, including Cossack cavalry, artillery, anti-aircraft guns, a limited amount of armor, and, apparently, air support. The 281st was able to encircle large numbers of partisans, and though the partisans were eventually able to evacuate some of their men, they suffered heavy losses in the process. This was still a brutal operation, for the division also seems to have killed many non-combatants, but the operation did apparently dispatch a large number of real partisans, and the loss to the Germans and their local auxiliaries of 16 killed and 66 wounded further shows they had something of a proper fight on their hands. Yet although some anti-partisan units were less brutal than others, this remained overall a brutal, indiscriminate, and ultimately counterproductive anti-partisan campaign. During the second half of 1942, Hitler and the OKW issued a sequence of anti-partisan directives that, though giving some nods to winning hearts and minds, generally hardened the anti-partisan campaign further. For instance, many anti-partisan operations were accompanied by propaganda troops who employed leaflets and loudspeakers to encourage partisans to desert, but the OKW's combat directive for anti-partisan warfare in the East of November 1942 merely stipulated that partisan deserters be treated as POWs according to circumstances. This gave the troops ample leeway to shoot them. Confusingly, it stated, on the one hand, that unjust punishment shakes the confidence of the population and creates new partisans, but on the other, that the severity of our measures and the fear of expected punishment must restrain the population from aiding or supporting the partisans. Units in the field replicated such confusion in their own orders. For Operation Monkey Cage, the 12th Panzer Division spared the lives of partisans who deserted during the fighting, several months before the OKW would eventually issue a similar directive to all anti-partisan units. Yet the division also made clear that brutal ruthlessness towards the bandits, their helpers, or their helpers' helpers is to be hammered into every man. Any moderating effect higher-level directives might have had then was limited by the decidedly mixed messages those directives were sending out, as well as by other directives that were straightforwardly ferocious. In particular, on 16 December, Hitler ordered the most brutal means against women and children also, declared any scruples in the matter as treasonous to the German people, and forbade officers to punish their troops for any excesses against the population. Two occupied populations whom the German army particularly tried to cultivate were the Muslim peoples of the Crimea and the Caucasus. The Sunni Tatars comprised a quarter of the Crimea's population, and German army administrators saw them, as they would also come to see their Muslim brethren in the Caucasus, as presenting an opportunity to woo Islam in the Soviet Union for political and military gain. The Germans granted the Tatars religious rights and concessions and reintroduced major religious holidays, and Manstein's otherwise infamous November 1941 order required his troops to treat the Tatars with respect. Following the Germans' final conquest of the Crimea in the summer of 1942, the Nationale Zeitung got the following quotation from Manstein. "The Tatars welcome the liberation from Moscow simply because the blasting of the chains has returned to them the free religious practice of Islam. Mosques and prayer halls were reopened, religious education was reintroduced into the school curriculum, and the Germans appointed a Muslim committee to re-establish the religious infrastructure. The army also wooed the Tatar population as a potential security force. It eventually employed over 20,000 Muslims in anti-partisan operations across the Crimea. The army viewed its occupation of the northern Caucasus as a further opportunity to woo a people genuinely opposed to communism. An instruction sheet to the troops stated, "The religion and the religious customs and conventions of the Caucasians must be respected and not be ridiculed, even though they may appear odd." The first commander of Army Group A, Field Marshal Liszt, pursued this policy, and his successor, General von Kleist, developed it further. In December 1942, Kleist stated, "Of all of the German army groups, Army Group A is advanced the furthest. We stand at the gates to the Islamic world. What we do and how we behave here will radiate deep into Iraq, to India, as far as to the borders of China. Thus, constantly be aware of the long-range effect of our actions and interactions." The Germans also used public holidays as a propaganda weapon. They arrived in the Caucasus at the end of Ramadan, and 70 days before the festival of Kurban Bayram. The Sunni Balkars and Kabardins in Nalchik held Kurban Bayram on 18 December. Otto Breutigam, a senior official in the Eastern Ministry, recorded that at the heart of the event was a religious ceremony on a stage in the local cinema. Kneeling with the body bent forward, around 50 leading figures of the community performed their prayers. The move to the clerics was solemn and controlled, and the religious ceremony took place in dignified seriousness. The religious representatives at the ceremony thanked the Germans for their liberation from Bolshevism and presented them with gifts, including carpets, clothing, and copies of the Koran for Hitler, Kleist, and Keitel. The German representatives reciprocated by distributing captured weapons, lighters, and watches, together with small Korans as a token of German respect for Islam. The Germans also promised the rapid abolition of Soviet collective farms. Yet the failings of German occupation were soon apparent to these Muslim peoples. The army drew the line at the Eastern Ministry's suggestion that a mufti for the Crimea be appointed, fearing he would be a powerful figurehead who might incite rebellion in the Tatars were their condition to deteriorate. The SS often executed Crimean Muslims in the crass belief that because they were circumcised, they must be Jewish. The Tatars eventually became alienated as the depredations of German occupation, particularly anti-partisan operations and economic plunder, grew more severe. The Germans, meanwhile, grew increasingly concerned that Tatar communities were being infiltrated by partisans. In the northern Caucasus also, German policy eventually proved a damp squib at best and a ruinous bane at worst. Officially, no more than 20% of the land was supposed to be redistributed to farmers in the Germans' agricultural reform, and the curtailing of the military campaign in the Caucasus eventually prevented the Germans from achieving even that. And as the military campaign turned against the Germans and their own supplies faltered, they ransacked the local economy and unleashed mass hunger in the process. Little further time elapsed before the Germans faced growing partisan activity and reacted with their usual ferocity. Army administrators also connived in enabling the SS and police to slaughter the Jews of the northern Caucasus as surely as they did Jews in the Crimea and elsewhere. From the start, the baleful ideological and economic agenda that the Nazis had set for the Soviet Union, the plethora of competing Nazi interest groups and the practical barriers facing an under-resourced military administration all hindered any attempt to establish a constructive occupation regime. Overall, the first of these factors had the most debilitating effect of the three, because only a saner agenda at the top would have assured the resources needed for saner occupation initiatives on the ground to have any significant effect. The increasingly voracious demands of the German war economy reinforced the exploitation and oppression that the occupied Soviet Union suffered. The breakdown in the population's food supply during the winter of 1941 to 1942 was a harbinger of the occupation's moral and practical failure, and of the scale of misery that resulted. Even the army's policy towards the favored Islamic populations of the Caucasus and Crimea failed in the end. Although military administrators on the ground often lacked insight into the occupied populations, many at least tried, for moral or more usually pragmatic reasons, to temper their prejudices and alleviate the population's suffering. After all, many hailed from an older, less Nazified generation. Moreover, the army's occupation troops interacted with the population in ways that were shaped not just by their prejudices, but also by the conditions they experienced and their close proximity to civilians. Similarly, the great majority of rear area troops belonged to the older age groups from which the army drew its rank and file. All other things being equal, then, they themselves were also less Nazified than their more youthful frontline comrades. The fact that many were men with families gave them a further insight into the adversity that afflicted occupied civilians. Thus did many occupation units and commands seek to cultivate the population more and terrorize it less. They were more likely to think this way, however, if the pressure from partisans was not so severe that it prevented them from developing a more considered approach to their occupation duties. By contrast, units under severe pressure from partisans or from the expectations of their superiors were in more desperate need of immediate results and more likely to resort to terror in order to achieve them. Nor, of course, were rear area units immune from anti-Slavic prejudice and harsh military perceptions themselves. Many reacted to their taxing circumstances and their sometimes chronic under-resourcing by treating the population with brutalized frustration and contempt. This, in turn, of course, only intensified the alienation and resistance that the German occupation provoked among the population. Chapter 15. Faces of Occupation, 1942-1943, Western Europe and Southeast Europe. During 1942 and the early months of 1943, the German army's occupation of Western and Southeast Europe pulled in contradictory